from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A call to action in the case of imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is Lynn Stewart. The life of brilliant journalist, intellectual, and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal is in great danger.
We'll have details later in this newscast. China expressed grave concern over the landing of two U.S. fighter jets in Taiwan last week. Taiwan's central news agency said the two F-818s landed at an Air Force base on the southern part of the island last Wednesday after experiencing mechanical problems. This was Hua Chunying, a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry, Thursday.
We have taken note of the relevant report and have lodged solemn representations with the U.S. side. China urges the U.S. to abide by the One China policy and the principles enshrined in the three joint communiques between China and the U.S. to prudently and properly handle relevant issues and prevent similar cases from emerging again.
Meanwhile, China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi began a two-day visit to Russia Monday to prepare for a meeting between the two countries' presidents. The foreign ministry says Wang and his Russian counterpart are scheduled to discuss the participation of President Xi Jinping in the May 9th events in Moscow, marking the end of World War II in Europe. We have this report from CCTV.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi is paying a two-day visit to Russia from Monday to prepare for a meeting between the two countries' presidents. The Russian Foreign Ministry says Wang Yi and his Russian counterpart are scheduled to discuss the participation of President Xi Jinping in May the 9th Moscow events marking the end of the Second World War in Europe. The Kremlin said last month, President Vladimir Putin may take part in China's parade on September the 3rd, marking the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. Now, for more on that, let's talk to Professor Wang Yiwei from Renmin University here in Beijing. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Wang. So first of all, tell us more about the relationship between China and Russia right now.
Well, China-Russia comprehensive strategic partnership for all coordination is a model of the great power relations in the 21st century. The two means, number one, I think, is to safeguard of the world peace. Given that the Eurasia is so-called the world island in the geopolitical scientist's eyes, so China-Russian coordination is the key to stable Eurasian stability and also for the world peace. And as the two permanent members of the United Nations Security Councils, China-Russian cooperation is also is a key to safeguard of the post-World War II international order.
Well, Professor, China has been actively promoting its One Belt, One Road initiatives, and Russia is one of the countries getting involved. So what does the initiatives offer to Russia?
Well, I think it's very important to include Russia, since that the U.S. Built the post-World War II order in Europe through the Marshall Plan or the NATO, which divided Europe, actually, so-called the keep Russian out of Europe, and caused the current Ukraine crisis. As in the Silk Road economic belt, this time extend to from Moscow to connect to Europe, it brings Russia in the Eurocontinent. I think this is the key for the long-term stability and prosperity of Russian and European corporations, and also jointly with China.
Thank you very much, Professor Wang Yiwei from Renmin University.
And controversy is brewing in Central Europe over the Victory Day celebration in Moscow, with the President of the Czech Republic, Miloš Zeman, at the center. We'll have more on that tomorrow. In Yemen, at least five more civilians were killed when Saudi warplanes bombed a village on the western outskirts of Sana'a. The victims were all members of a single family killed in a fresh Saudi airstrike as Riyadh pushes ahead with its military campaign against Houthi Ansarullah revolutionary forces in the impoverished Arab country. Yemen-based Arab language Watan News Agency reported that local sources, speaking on a condition of anonymity, said the victims lost their lives when Saudi military aircraft fired several missiles Monday into a number of houses in a village which lies on the western outskirt of the Yemeni capital. Thus far, hundreds of civilians, including men, women, and children, have been killed in the Saudi airstrikes against Yemen. Fighting in that country has intensified, and according to the UN Humanitarian Office, OCHA, the Saudi-led airstrikes are driving an increasing number of people to flee Sana'a. The UN has warned that the country is close to what it called total collapse. Daniel Dickinson reports.
OCHA says that in the last 24 hours, airstrikes have targeted areas across the country. According to local sources, one strike in Sadar killed 8 civilians, and in Aden, fighting was reportedly spreading towards residential areas. The latest UN estimates indicate around 550 people were killed and over 1,700 injured between the 19th of March and the 3rd of April. Displacement continues to be reported. Increasing numbers of people from Sadar and Sana'a are reportedly moving to Amran Governorate. Local partners estimate that up to 28,000 people have arrived in Amran since the crisis began. Meanwhile, the International Committee of the Red Cross is set to make emergency aid flights into Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The ICRC, which is a UN partner agency, has been given permission to land planes carrying staff and medical supplies in Yemen. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Saudi Arabia's air campaign against Yemen started on March 26th without a UN mandate in a bid to restore power to Yemen's former president, Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi, a close ally of the Saudi government. Hadi had stepped down in January and fled to Aden, where he tried to set up a rival power base. He fled Aden on March 20th to Riyadh after Ansarullah fighters advanced on the port city. And on Monday, there were some signs that the fighting may well be extending into Saudi Arabia itself. One Saudi policeman was killed and 4 injured during raids on a Shia-dominated oil-rich eastern province of Saudi Arabia, as the Saudi-led coalition bombardment of rebels in neighboring Yemen prompted fears that the fighting is spilling over the border. RT's Marina Dishashi has more.
In Saudi Arabia itself, a police crackdown on a Shia minority in the eastern province has turned into a full-scale battle. One police officer was killed in the fighting. Locals say more than 30 people were arrested, but those reports have been denied by the authorities. And the government says it is tackling terrorist elements in the region. However, activists believe the police raid came as punishment for protest against the Saudi intervention in Yemen. Now, the area where the clashes took place has long been a hub of anti-government protests. It is home to most of Saudi Arabia's Shia Muslim minority. Locals say they are being discriminated against by the Sunni rulers and treated as second-class citizens. To talk more on the story, I'm now joined by political analyst Kamel Wazni. Thank you so much, Mr. Wazni, for joining us here in ATT International. Now, first off, how much of a concern is the situation for the Saudi Arabian authorities?
Well, if I heard the question right, I think it's a lot of tense situation in the region and in Saudi Arabia. Obviously, the tension that is going and the confrontation that is taken against Yemen, it's not going to leave Saudi Arabia without any consequences and ramification. Obviously, there's a large minority that exists in Saudi Arabia. They've been deprived for a very long time from their basic rights, and they've been treated for like a second class. And I think with the tension that is taking place in Yemen and in Bahrain and in Iraq and throughout the region, I think everything can be fall apart if we don't find a solution for what is taking place.
Indeed, the situation is very volatile. Mm-hmm. Sorry for interrupting you. Indeed, the situation is very volatile. But specifically, what's happening? How do you see it? I mean, do you see it as a spillover from the Saudi-led intervention in Yemen?
I think everything will be actually exploded at any time, especially if the confrontation goes on for a very long time without finding a political solution. I think the Saudis are playing with fire, and the way they're going about it, they think they invested in military equipment for like 4 years, spending probably more money than countries like India. They can resolve things with with their aircraft, not knowing that their aircraft so far hasn't actually achieved anything. I think logic and reason and political solution would be the answer to solve the crisis. Otherwise, I think the Saudi, they did a major blunder here, a major miscalculation by entering this war, and this is cannot make the Saudi bleed for a very long time, and actually it has weakened the Saudi position in the international community when you see these innocent children being killed the way they are and the way the level of destruction. And you're talking about Yemen. Yemen is one of the poorest country in the world. There is 10 million people actually live below poverty. Yemen does not need those F-16, F-15 to bombard its territory. It needs help. It needs food. It needs shelter. It needs water. It needs medical supplies.
Well, indeed, and the situation there is quite dire.
Capable.
Yeah, totally. The situation there is quite dire, as you're describing this to us and painting a picture there. But how much of a role did religion play in the Saudi decision to intervene in Yemen? And is there a danger of perhaps a broader Shia-Sunni conflict there?
I think the Saudi, they have this hype and this fears about religion. I think the fear, it is from Saudi Arabia, from the Wahhabi, from their own ideology that is more threat to Saudi Arabia than anything else. I think the level of fear that they raise and they try to create a phobia in the world, I think the fear and the most fear that Saudi afraid from their children that they can turn against them. But the threat that always Saudi Arabia talk about it from the region, from Iran, and other part of countries that believe in different ideology is not really has no merit. I think Obama was right when he said that they have to take care of their internal issues before they can look at and start raising red flag here and there. I think that the threat, it is from Saudi Arabia itself, what it has been doing with these ideology that has spent hundreds of billion teaching these ideology that actually spreading a lot of terrorism around the world. And this has really been a fact.
Another indicator that, despite the predictions from Washington and Brussels, U.S. and EU sanctions and manipulation of world petroleum prices have not caused Russia's economy to collapse. The Russian ruble hit 55.3 to the dollar Monday, its highest value this year. The ruble has become the world's best performer during the first 3 months of 2015, after finishing 2014 as one of the biggest losers. The Russian currency gained more than 1% against the U.S. dollar, standing at 55.3 to the dollar and 60.8 to the euro at the closing on Monday of the Moscow exchange, with oil prices being one of the drivers for the ruble's climb through the day. Yevgeny Shilenkov, the head of trading at Velas Capital LLC in Moscow, told Bloomberg, quote, "None of my expectations regarding the ruble came true. This is our new reality. There are too many different factors affecting the ruble. There are too many elements in the ruble matrix. The ruble is completely unpredictable," closed quote. One factor, Russia is a net exporter, and according to Alexander Prosviryakov, a treasury and commodities manager at PricewaterhouseCoopers, the weakened currency, rather than crippling the economy, has actually helped to stimulate greater growth. He spoke with RT's Tim Kirby Monday.
Of course, it's bad for the people that used to spend their money abroad, that basically make their money in Russia, make rubles, get a ruble salary, and then they go outside of Russia to spend it. Yeah, these guys, it's going to hurt for them. But if you look at the economy, of course, is going to do better. We are an exporting country. We export much more than we import. And this is why if our local currency is cheaper, it makes we make a higher margin on everything that we export.
Nice.
So we make much more profit for the country, and this is what basically makes our producers feel much better. And new sectors, like we call this, like everything that we used to import, now we can produce ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw signs of some car manufacturers, they started to enter Russia and basically use us as a platform to manufacture the cars here and export them to other countries. That never happened before, because usually car producers, they manufacture somewhere else,
yeah,
and they sold it in Russia, but now they manufacture in Russia and start selling in other countries. So this will lead to the fact that the economy will grow much faster. So this is a good thing for the economy. But of course, if you make the same amount of money in rubles and you always flew to Europe to spend the money, it's bad for you. But on the other hand, if you look at the euro rate against the dollar, the euro collapsed. It collapsed about...
My wife was even just saying, she made a little Facebook post. She was like, wasn't it like a year ago that there were 35 rubles to the dollar and something like 50 rubles to the euro? And now it has leveled off to being like 60 and 60 even. So what's going on with Europe? Why is the euro devaluating so quickly?
Yeah, if we look at the fundamentals, Europe is really fighting with deflation. Like, we have a problem here called inflation. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, there is deflation, which is not good.
Why not? Deflation sounds nice. You're getting more for every euro you have. That sounds nice.
Yeah, but it is negative interest rates. You put money in a bank, you put 100,000, you get like 99 back. So you're not making money.
The dark side.
Yeah, if we look at Japan, there was the same kind of problem, and it lasted for a number of years, and it's very hard for them to fight it. That's why the economy in Japan is not growing for so many years. And the same risk, that Europe faces the same risk now. So what they started to do is this thing called quantitative easing is when the European Central Bank started issuing money and buying the bonds in order to fight this deflation. And this makes the currency depreciate. And it is very good for Russia because most of the stuff that we export is in dollars, and most of the stuff that we import is in euros.
Yeah.
So our imports became cheaper because the euro fell, and the dollar basically stayed the same level compare it, like if we use dollar as a benchmark. So this is much better for the country. Not many people realize this because they usually count imports in dollars, but the currency of the imports is euros.
A call to action in the case of imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. On Monday, March 30th, Abu-Jamal lost consciousness at the State Correctional Institute, Mahanoy, and had to be rushed to the hospital. This was noted human rights lawyer and former political prisoner Lynn Stewart Monday.
Life of brilliant journalist, intellectual, and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal is in great danger. On March 30th, after months of medical neglect, Mumia went into diabetic shock and was hospitalized with life-threatening high blood sugar. Just 2 days later, he was transferred back to the same prison that failed to diagnose or treat him. His diet is dangerous, and his health is deteriorating. Only massive pressure will stop his execution through malpractice. Call Pennsylvania Corrections Secretary John Wetzel at 717-728-4109. That's 717-728-4109. Demand that Mumia be allowed treatment by specialists of his choosing, the proper diabetic diet, and daily visits by family, friends, and attorneys. For more on how you can act to save Mumia's life, go to bringmumiahome.com. That's bringmumiahome.com, or on Facebook, search for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Inadequate treatment of diabetes is life-threatening. It can lead to loss of kidney function, nerve neuropathy, and amputation of limbs. Abu-Jamal's medical emergency followed several months of health problems, including elevated glucose levels that were not addressed by prison healthcare staff. That resulted in a rapid deterioration of his condition with near-fatal consequences. After he was taken to the hospital last Monday, Abu-Jamal was held incommunicado for approximately 24 hours. Family members were then permitted to visit Tuesday and Wednesday of last week after the Pennsylvania prison system received an international outcry. On Wednesday, April 1st, Abu-Jamal was transported back to the prison infirmary without having seen a diabetics specialist, without a diagnosis of the cause of his diabetic shock, and without a treatment plan. Abu-Jamal was visited again this past Friday and again Monday and is still in medical danger. His blood sugar levels are still unstable, reaching 300 at one point on Friday. He had to be taken to the visiting room in a wheelchair, has lost a substantial amount of weight, and has other symptoms that require specialized diagnostic and treatment that is not available at the prison infirmary. Supporters say Mumia Abu-Jamal must see an endocrinologist that specializes in diabetes in order to be properly diagnosed and treated with a plan specific to his condition. They said that prison officials have a constitutional obligation to treat serious medical needs, and that includes specialist care which is medically indicated for newly onset diabetes. And we close today with this from Danny Haifong about his contribution this week to BlackAgendaRadio.com.
Well, I often don't read the New York Times because it's pretty useless at this point, given how the corporate media is consolidated into just six mega monopolies that ultimately act as a mouthpiece for Washington. But I was browsing it last month, in the month of March, and I noticed that there are numerous attacks on Iran given the nuclear deal that is being discussed by the P5 plus one, but also given Israel's sensitive electoral period and the intense war in Yemen. The attack on Iran is heightening, and the New York Times came out with multiple pieces, two of which I decided to focus on, and one of which I think is probably more important than the other, which is Thomas Friedman's short racist and imperialist op-ed, basically making the ridiculous claim that the U.S. war on terror since 2003 and the invasion of Iraq has basically been one that has helped Iran over the years, and that now the U.S. has shifted strategy to arming and helping ISIS, the lesser of two evils, he calls it, when comparing it to Iran. And so his argument is to arm and fund ISIS, go figure, to destabilize the Islamic Republic. And
Hang on, let me stop you there for a minute. Let's do a touch of a reality check to, you know, run like a reality narrative to a degree against both Friedman's arguments and who was it, Bolton on the other side?
John
Bolton. Yeah, we'll get to him. As if they're on other opposite sides. The Islamic Republic was created out of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, which was the overthrow of the Shah, who had been imposed by a CIA-backed coup against the elected government of Iran in 1953.
Right. Yeah.
And Iran has not invaded or otherwise taken military action against any country in the past at least 250 years, with the exception of defensive war when attacked by Iraq, but with the U.S. backing back in the 1980s. Yeah. The Middle East, of course, is afire with all kinds of terrorist groups, and absent some relationship between Iran and the nationalist movements in Palestine Bahrain protection of the Syrian government, which was reelected by about 65% of the every Syrian on the planet this past year. Iran is not related in any way, but rather a target of and hostile to Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra Front, whatever, ISIS, the whole list of terrorist organizations. So how exactly is Iran a threat in the first place?
It's not. The only reason Iran has been a threat over the last five decades plus since the U.S. has been waging war on the nation is due to its geopolitical and strategic position in the world. It has 10% of all of the world's oil resources, and its very sovereignty, the very idea that Iran stands as a sovereign nation able to make its own decisions about its political and economic trajectory, makes it a threat in a region where the U.S. has set it ablaze with jihadist terrorist networks, which makes it very ironic that Thomas Friedman, this liberal imperialist warmonger who has done this before in the case of Iraq during the invasion in 2003, where he basically makes a complete distortion of historical reality, and basically argues for a policy that has been longstanding when it comes to the U.S., NATO, Western, and GCC war on terror that it has waged over the past 10 to 15 years. So really, Iran's sovereignty is the threat to the United States, because it is that example, and it is the pariah states of Israel and Saudi Arabia and all of its allies that have sparked a very heavy anti-U.S. and anti-Western sentiment in the region, which threatens to cut off the capitalists, the United States and the West, and all of its allies from very important economic and political activity in the region.
And then you have, just for a little more geopolitical context, regionally, the surviving regional powers, after the destruction of Iraq and Libya and the neutralization of Egypt and the current attacks on Syria, you have, on the one hand, Saudi Arabia. On another hand, you have Israel, and on another hand, you have Iran, with the Saudis and the Israelis each seeing Iran as a rival and actively cooperating against both Iran and the other powers I just named in their dismantling.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting because each of these imperialist nations, they're in a pretty tight alliance based on the objective reality that each of them have the very same policy, the very same imperialist policy and interests, which have been spelled out pretty clearly. I mean, Israel has plenty of policy documents from Clean Break, which was written partially by Netanyahu himself in 1996, the Yanan Plan, which was written in the 1980s, through a Zionist educational institution. And in the United States, we have General Wesley Clark in 2000. I think it was 2007, where he...
A list. Yeah, right.
Yeah, where he interviewed with Democracy Now! And stated that there were seven nations, Iran included, and Iran actually being the last target on the list, given the strategic importance of isolating it. But the whole entire policy of each of these nations is to destabilize the region, create states way too chaotic to govern themselves, and to do so in maybe some different ways. Israel has the idea of no states, and Saudi Arabia has the idea of states that are compliant with its fascist regime, and the United States has a policy of, whichever works. But ultimately what's happened is that these nations' policies in the region have created a situation of destabilization that ultimately targets Iran. And this explains why, on all fronts, the New York Times has come out and promoted both sides of the imperialist coin, from the liberal proxy war narrative to the right-wing Bolton bomb Iran, it's time to intervene narrative. But both are no less destructive, and both have very similar consequences and are ultimately very interconnected.
And if you think about how politics work in... where politics works in Washington, you end up with a consensus position, which is that they both bomb it and fight proxy wars, which is exactly right. What happened in Libya.
Yep, and it happened in Iraq just recently with...
It's happening now in Syria.
Yeah, in Syria with the so-called proliferation of ISIS in Iraq, and Iraqi MPs for months now have been outlining the fact that the U.S. war on ISIS that it declared late last year and early into this year was all a fabrication. There were military jets dropping weapons into ISIS-held territories, while at the same time the U.S. has been engaging in attacks on Iraqi national military forces in these same territories, which calls into question, well, what exactly is the U.S. trying to do here?
Who's on what side?
Yeah, the whole war on terror, including the attack on Syria, was never about, and Iran, was never about the fight against terrorism or the fight against dictatorial regimes. It was always about hegemony. But in this period, are ultimately creating more chaos and more issues for the United States than its interests. It's not really achieving them at the moment.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.